A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.
White text appears on black. Art is dangerous. It is one of the attractions. When it ceases to be dangerous, you don't want it. Duke Ellington. Amid the controversy of Dave Chappelle's Netflix release, The Closer, Duke Ellington School of the Arts resolved to name its newly renovated theater the Dave Chappelle Theater. The following is Dave's acceptance speech for that honor, June 20th, 2022, inside the Grand White Building of the Duke Ellington School.
This is surreal.
Dave Chappelle paces on a stage. He wears a gray suit with a white shirt and white sneakers.
In 1987, I moved back from Ohio to D.C. and enrolled in Eastern High School and did... You must not have went there when I went there, champ.
He grins and taps his mic on his leg.
Those were tough times, is the way I remember it.
Projected on a screen behind him is a white sea with red, black, and green around it.
When I had gone, I'd lived with my father for 3 years. I went to middle school in Ohio, and when I'd gotten back to Washington, the crack epidemic was in full swing, and the city was largely unrecognizable to me. And I was an older kid, and kids my age were doing a lot of wild things that I didn't know the kids would do. I'd never seen a kid with a pager before. I didn't know anything about selling drugs or any of that shit. All I knew was every day when I went to Eastern, I didn't feel safe.
He taps the mic. He paces. Stage lights shine on his bald head.
I'm a quiet guy, naturally. I'm a shy person, naturally. And I used to get my hair cut on a barbershop in 15th Street Northeast. And I would go there, and everyone in the barbershop would just snap on each other. And I'd sit in the corner and I'd watch everybody and just listen to all these jokes. The guys were funny as shit, but one day, after a few weeks of going there getting my hair cut, they turned the jokes on me. I call that day the barbershop massacre. I lit everybody in that barbershop up. I've been sitting in there listening to them for weeks talk about each other. I knew every inside joke about each and every one of them, and they couldn't believe I knew this stuff. I lit their asses up. And from then on in the neighborhood, people kind of liked me. Oh, this guy's, he's pretty funny. Time Magazine released an article about Bill Cosby. The headline said, 50 Funny and Filthy Rich. And I read that article, and it was when I was looking at his face before all that disgrace that I looked and I said, I could do that. I told my father, and my father said, well, then just do it. I said, well, I wouldn't even know where to start. And he said, well, look in the phone book. It was before the internet, if you're young. We used to have a book with phone numbers in it of.
Dave looks down at the stage and puts a hand in his pocket.
My father found for me the local comedy club in Washington, D.C. I called him. I found out when open mic night was, and I started to go there on Tuesday nights and just watch. And then one night I went on a weekend. I would get my money together and I would go to this comedy club and I would just watch these comedians. And sometimes they would talk to me. And I told one of the comedians after a show one night, I said, man, I really want to try to do this. And he said, well, he said, if you want to be a good comedian, you should know how to act. I said, why? And he says, you know, he didn't explain it. I said, okay, and I told my parents, and this is how I came to find out about Duke Ellington. My mother, she said, there's a place you can go where you can learn to act right here in Washington. It's a high school. I said, you mean I would get out of Eastern?
He gives a wide-eyed smile.
The school year was already in full swing, and Ellington has a policy that they don't let people just come in the middle of the year. But Linda Gravatt, who was the head of the theater department at the time, very graciously took a meeting with me and my mother and...
He shakes his head.
I get emotional thinking about it. Anybody that went here... Remember what it was first like? When you first walked through the door. And it was in the afternoon and everyone was in their arts classes and the girls had tutus on. And everyone was weird and walking around the hallway like you weren't sure anyone was supposed to be, and you could hear people practicing their horns and shit all through the hallways. There was art bouncing off the walls. The minute I walked through the door, there was a gallery of all these children's work, and these pictures were amazing.
Dave wipes his eye and flicks his hand downward. He briefly rests a foot on a monitor speaker.
My first thought, when I walked to that door, I'm not good enough to be here, I'm sure. Miss Gravatt sat me down, she told me about the school, and you remember Miss Gravatt, she was very businesslike, but also very warm. She was intimidating, but palpably kind. She was a paradox of a human being. And she gave me a date for an audition. My mother said, okay, Dave, it's on you. Now, those of you who know me know that I didn't prepare for that audition. That audition was like a possession. It was just something that I was proud to have. But as the days got closer, I'm like, oh my God, I gotta get something together. I didn't even know how to do an audition. I'd never done it before. So I went, I said, what do I need? They said a monologue. So I looked up monologue. And I went to the library, the MLK library, this huge library, and said, I gotta find something. And I found a piece in one of those yellow script books. It was a monologue by Mark Twain called The Judge's Spirited Woman. I learned it in a night. You know, it was not hard for me to memorize things. The next day, it was a Saturday, I think, and I came to the school, and they auditioned. What used to be this room, the original theater at Duke Ellington School of the Arts. And all the department heads sat in here and the lights are in your eyes, and there's a bunch of kids who already go to the school who come on Saturday just to see who might be coming. And I talked to all these kids before I went in, and these kids were nothing like the kids at Easton. They were like them, but they were different. They were weird and funny and self-deprecating, things like this. And I remember I came out on stage and I did my audition, and it was like terrible. I froze up in the beginning. I started, and then I said, wait a minute, I'm messing up. Let me start again. And I was nervous, and I was scared. And in the middle of the audition, I'm in the middle of the monologue, one of the teachers, Fred Leach, he said, Fred Leach, he goes, okay, that's enough. I said, well, there's still a little more. He goes, no, that is enough, he said. And I can't tell you, like, I was crushed. Without saying his disapproval, I knew it stunk. And I was right. When I walked in here, I knew I wasn't good enough to go to this school. And I thought to myself, ah, fuck this school. That's stupid anyway.
With one foot resting on a monitor, Dave gazes out at the audience. He glances down and touches his face.
In first year theater, there's a question that they ask students from time to time. And it's a make or break question. And when we ask this question, you don't know. And the question is this. They say, why do you want to act? Now, if you say anything like, I want to be a star, you're not going to get in. I didn't know that. And I figured I already blew the audition, so I told him the truth. He said, why do you want to act? I don't. That's what I said. And they said, well, then why are you here? I said, because I want to be a comedian, and some comedian told me that if I want to be a good comedian, I need to learn how to act. And teachers look at each other and go, thank you very much, and I left.
He frowns and gives a shrug.
And I was walking down the hallway, kicking rocks.
He stops and looks down. A smile spreads on his lips.
There was a kid that already went here. His name was Echo Handy. And Echo said, hey, man, I listened to him talking about you. I said, you did? He said, you're in. I said, what? He said, you're in. Well, it didn't make any sense. Somehow we worked it out so that they gave me an early enrollment, and I left Easton within weeks of that. And I came to Duke Ellington, and it was better than I could have ever imagined. I didn't have the suspicion that most new kids get. I was an oddity, a new toy. I was quirky. I wasn't a snappy dresser. I didn't really know what the fuck was going on because the crack epidemic itself was new to me, and they were all refugees from their neighborhood schools.
Dave stares down. He lifts his head.
In the morning, we would have our academic classes, and then in the afternoon, we would have our arts classes. It was a long school day. We started 8:30. We wouldn't leave here at 5, sometimes 5:30, whenever they saw fit.
He paces.
It's funny walking in here tonight, because I saw the pride flags up. And I remember when I came here all those years ago, it's the first time I'd ever met a kid who was just like gay. And was never strange to us. Their sexuality or their gender identity was the least remarkable thing about a person that could dance as well as Roger Bellamy or there was no distinction between any of that. Everybody was weird in their own way. And in a very strange way, because we spent so much time with one another, we helped raise one another. There's a camaraderie between these students that I don't know that I've seen since I left this school. I can remember, and I won't say names, there was a student that went here that used to sell drugs. It wasn't just a student, but this particular guy. This particular guy did the cardinal no-no on the streets. He did what they call not making your roll, which meant that he got some drugs on consignment and he didn't pay whoever gave him the drugs back. And whoever gave him those drugs had declared, I'm gonna come to that school and I'm gonna kill you, he said. And my man was scared. And the word got around school, that the goons was coming. And by the time the goons showed up, every dude that went to this school, gay, straight, whatever the fuck, was all standing out front. They said, you have to kill all of us. And who was in front of all of them? Roger Bellamy with some leg warmers on like this.
Dave strikes a pose, cocking his hip and planting one foot out to the side. He toys with his pocket square and paces.
I started making friends that are still my friends to this very day, lifelong friends. As I get older, I appreciate my teachers more and more. But to tell you the truth, I appreciated them then. Teacher salaries, you know, not necessarily what it should be. And when I think about that, juxtaposed to the dedication that the teachers, the time they would spend to me, the way they would notice, are you okay? Is everything all right? You look sad today. Any little thing, like a family member would. And they fostered an environment of almost absolute trust, like your parents. There's two lectures. that I got at school that changed the way I do comedy, that like turned a light switch on. It was two teachers, Donald East. Donald East, may he rest in peace. Maybe one of the single best educators that I've ever met in my life. He had a demeanor about himself that demanded excellence from his students. He would tell us incredible stories that I didn't believe. He claimed in one class, the song Killing Them Softly was about him. I was like, nah, nigga, not you. He told me he knew Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack and all these people, these DC legends. He's a humble man, but he really demanded excellence. And he gave us a lecture once on a concept called polarization. Polarization meaning the idea that if you can make everybody look at the same thing at the same time, that their rational mind will decrease and the emotional response will increase. He said, that's how audiences work. That's how mobs work. That's how you make a person lose themselves in the crowd. I got it. As he was saying this, he would hold a staple in his hand. It was a good lecture. He'd say, everyone focus on the staple. And then he would explain to us what polarization is as we're all looking at the staple. And then he'd scream, ha! And everyone would jump, oh. And he said, what you scared of? Oh, shit, that works. And ever since he did that lecture, I listened in his class intently. He was one of the only guys that I would always get straight A's from because I worked very hard not to get his approval, but to avoid his disapproval. When we were coming up, they had a thing called juries. I don't know, do they still do juries? Juries is when all the department heads give you a piece to work on and they sit there and they make you perform the piece, and the criticism is brutal. We were kids. We didn't understand that they were preparing us for a hard world ahead. If you wanted a profession in art, they would tear us to shreds. The stress of a jury, and man, I never practiced. Because I didn't want to act. At an improv class, a teacher named Geraldine Gilstrap told me that I should stop doing funny pieces, that I should try to stretch myself artistically, that maybe I had more in me than comedy. And at the time, I took offense to that. So because she said that, after school that very night, I went to the comedy club. For the first time, I signed the list, and I waited, and I got on, and I killed it. Killed it. Must have been 35 years ago, night after night, I killed it. I'd show up with a bag of tricks that I learned at school, and I would dominate adults on a regular basis.
He bows his head.
Couldn't wait to get out of DC. When I was 17, I moved to New York and lit that comedy scene up. I was obviously talented. You'll hear stories about people saying that I discovered Dave Chappelle. It's like saying you discovered sunshine. I was shining on everybody. And when I got in that professional world, I was oddly prepared. I had a sense of professionalism. I showed up on time. I did the things that I learned in school to do, just the basics. My career didn't have any direction because I was still so young. And that didn't change for many years. It didn't change until my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, told me she was pregnant. And I was like, you know what? I should really start taking this seriously.
He frowns and shakes his head.
When she told me that, before the baby was born, I had done my first HBO special, and then I went to work on a sketch comedy show idea I had, and Chappelle show came out when my son was still maybe 18 months years old. And I bet on myself. I took less money. I took less money, I remember that, so I could do what I wanted to do. I said, you don't have to pay me that much, but you can't ever tell me, can't ever tell me that I can't do what I want to do. I did the first season, I'll tell you, for $300,000. It sounds like a lot of money, but.
He lifts an eyebrow, then shifts his weight.
It was a rare experience in my life because it was the first time that I did something that was so successful that I knew I had exceeded the expectations. I was more successful than I felt like I was supposed to be. They didn't plan on that. The second season came out and it was a juggernaut, and then I remember this was the single best day of my career. The Rick James episode of Chappelle's Show had come out. People were going crazy about the Rick James episode at the same time the DVD for season one of Chappelle's Show dropped. It was the first time any television show had ever been sold off air, and it sold 1 million copies in the first day. It was unheard of. To this day, nothing has sold more than Chappelle's Show. It's still on the top 10 in Netflix. All those great things happened, and my contract was up, clearly. Clearly, I was about to be rich. I'll spare you all the details of why it didn't work out. But it didn't work out. And I ended up doing something that no one had ever seen before, including myself. Maybe Prince is the only other guy that I've seen do this, where he just quit something that was popular when you're at the very top of it. Lucky for me, when I quit, I went to Africa, so there was a media storm that I didn't hear. By the time I got back, everyone was just looking at me crazy.
He leans back and raises his eyebrows.
That was a very difficult decision to make. The entire world told me I was crazy, but I was sure I was being true to myself and to something that I learned at Ellington. I'm one of those comedians that thought of himself as an artist. I was enamored by what the genre could do. It was like the pictures that I could paint with words and the way I could engage with audiences. I understood as it was happening, I was very lucky to be able to do this. And I protected that. And I knew that if I took the money, they would expect me to behave differently. And I wasn't willing to accept that. So I quit. And when I quit, it was a very difficult time in my life that I'll spare you the details, but man, fuck show business. It was tough. And then one day I was in Panama City, Panama, and I was at a hotel, and I looked at the lobby. There was a painting of Abraham Lincoln. And then I looked closer. It wasn't a painting. It was all pennies, just pennies, on a black canvas arranged into the face of Abraham Lincoln. And I asked the guy, I said, how much is that painting worth? He said, $600,000, sir. And I looked at the pennies that made up the painting, and I was like, that's like $300 worth of pennies.
He scrunches up his face and snaps.
Light bulb went in my head. I realized the value of art. Some of the biggest wars and crimes and scandals in history were financed through the theft of art. Art is a powerful commodity. An artist, if you're good at it, should never behave as a commodity. That's a tough one.
Dave turns his back. He ambles toward two chairs with a small table between them. He reaches down, then turns back to the audience.
And then I gave up. I said, this is probably it. I accepted the fact that the career I thought I was gonna have was over, but I started to rediscover just my art for its own sake. I would go to comedy clubs and I worked for way less money than I ever had, and I enjoyed it more than any of the work I ever did. It was probably the best work I'll ever do, because it was so honest, it was so sincere. There was no media, there was no studio, there was no scrutiny, just me and the crowds. And I did it night after night, and slowly but surely the crowds got bigger and bigger. And then suddenly people started to notice, and Polestar would say, Dave Chappelle has the tour of the year. And again, and then the year after that, and then the year after that. And then Lorne Michaels asked me to do Saturday Night Live. And it wasn't just like he asked me. He was courting me. I didn't even know it. He gave me this whole long speech. I was like, all right. And then I read some book about Lorne Michaels starting Saturday Night Live, and I read the speech that he gave Richard Pryor when he wanted him to host the show, and I said, holy shit, that's the same shit he said to me. And I did it. And that was an enormous amount of pressure. It had been 12 years since I had been on television, or since I had even talked to the media. And I remember I signed my Netflix contract on my way to my mark for the monologue. If you do live television, they count down every second. 30 seconds. Are you sure this contract is good? It's good, just sign the paper, it's good. 22 seconds. Oh, nigga, you better not be tricking me.
Dave Mimes signing a paper.
10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1. I walked out on that stage and I killed it. It was natural. It was nothing. It was easy work. Got an Emmy for that one, too. First Emmy I won. And when I walked on the stage, after being in the cold for so long, for the first time when I walked on the stage, I'm like, damn, nigga, I just made $60 million. That's what I thought to myself. It's been great ever since.
Dave stands with his hand in his pocket and his head bowed.
Really, I could do these specials like Steph Curry. I'd be shooting from inside, outside, all night. It's been great ever since. A lot of my friends are athletes, and I never could understand what it would feel like to only have a limited amount of time to be great. You got 20 years to be the best, or 30 years to be the best. But when you do art, you could be great whenever the well decides that you're great. I feel very lucky for that. And I never forgot this school. I've always come back and checked in. One of my favorite honors was doing the commencement at Ellington. That's, I can't even remember what year it is. I just remember they cheered for me when I came out. I wasn't a big star, but I was their star. And I felt like I was home. After I did Lorne Michaels, after I did Saturday Night Live, Lorne Michaels said something that I gotta share with you. He goes, you went to Peggy Cayford School, didn't you? That's what he said. And I said, I did. And he said, I want to say to Saturday Night Live, he goes, tell her I owe her money. You know, I never asked to have this theater named after me. Peggy asked me. She was ailing, and I went to her house to visit her. She said, I want you to put your name on the school. She said, it will help us raise money for the school. And to me, it was like, I felt like I'm a little young for that, and I'm still kind of using the name, you know what I mean? Let's see what I do with it first. You never know, you know what I mean? Like, imagine if OJ named his son OJ Jr. Oh, Dad.
Dave paces, staring at the floor.
And around then, I was receiving the Mark Twain Prize, huge honor. And the next day, all the artists that came to honor me, the Bradley Coopers and Chris Tuckers and all these great people, came to Ellington and they taught master classes for the students. And Peggy Cooper Cayfritz, as sick as she was, got out of her bed so she could be with her babies. She never left us. So I did it. Say, you know, whatever you want to do, if I can help, I'll do it. I got to tell you, if you quit a show like Chappelle's Show, I don't know if you know what happens to you professionally, but I'll tell you what doesn't happen. They don't just say, well, good luck in your future endeavors. With that media, they beat me up. With their power, they tried to make me behave. It takes a strong person to stand out in the cold like that And I swear to God, so much of the strength I got to do that, the inner warmth I got to do that, I learned in this school and from my friends who helped raise me. So why wouldn't I do anything I could to help my benefactor? And the last time I came back, after the closer, when the kids were mad at me, I got to tell you, that was quite the day. All the kids were screaming and yelling. I remember I said to the kids, I go, well, okay, well, what do you guys think I did wrong? And a line formed.
Dave leans forward and grins. He paces back and forth.
These kids said everything about gender and this and that and the other, but they didn't say anything about art. And this is my biggest gripe with this whole controversy with the closer, that you cannot report on an artist's work and remove artistic nuance from his words. It would be like if you were reading a newspaper and they say, man shot in the face by a 6-foot rabbit, expected to survive. You'd be like, oh my God. And they never tell you it's a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Dave blinks. He shifts his weight and looks out at the audience.
I took a lot of cold shots in show business. And I gotta tell you, as the years go on, you feel the shots less and less. As just the business is what you say. But that one, that day, boy, that day they hurt me. When I heard those talking points coming out of these children's faces, that really, sincerely hurt me. Because I know those kids didn't come up with those words. I've heard those words before. The more you say I can't say something, the more urgent it is for me to say it. And it has nothing to do with what you're saying I can't say. It has everything to do with my right, my freedom of artistic expression that is valuable to me, that is not separate from me. It's worth protecting for me, and it's worth protecting for everyone else who endeavors in our noble, noble professions. And these kids, didn't understand that they were instruments of oppression. And I didn't get mad at them. They're kids, they're freshmen, they're not ready yet. They don't know. What made me mad, and I am this petty, I ain't saying names. One of the kids' mother went on Fox News. And she used to be a student here. I remember her face, but I don't know if she was particularly popular. Anyway.
Dave smirks as he paces.
She was in the Literary Media Arts Department. She said a lot of things that I didn't like. A lot of things, but, you know, that's her right. Things she said that got to me. She said, at Duke Ellington, that theater was a sanctuary for students. I used to sit there and meditate. Well, of course you'd meditate. You were a literary media arts student. We didn't meditate in here, we got to work. But okay, fine. I would sit in there and meditate, she said. And then she scrunched her face up. She's a beautiful woman, but her face looked hideous the way she scrunched it up. And she said, and just to imagine his name on that theater, how could you do that to those kids? Listen. No matter what they said about the closer, it was still the most watched special in the world. And I am still of the mind, and I say this with all humility, it is a masterpiece. And I challenge all my peers, to make its equal. They cannot. I am sure. It will be decades before you ever see someone in my genre as proficient as me. I am maybe a once-in-a-lifetime talent. I am telling you the truth. About 3 weeks ago, I saw in the newspaper that a man that was dressed in women's clothing threw a pie at the Mona Lisa and tried to deface it. And it made me laugh because I'm like, it's like the closer. I said it to the kids that day, if you have a better idea, then express it, and you can beat me. It's that easy. If you have more talent than me, then display it, and you can beat me with certainty. This is what our genre is about. The idea that my name will be turned into an instrument of someone else's perceived oppression is untenable to me. The fact that if my name was on this theater and a kid that walked through that door would feel anything other than pride in their school and in their endeavors, well, that's untenable to me. So on Friday, I decided that I don't want my name on the school. Hear me out. The Ellington family is my family. When this controversy came out, when the students were angry, at the height of their anger, they said, we still want to name the theater after you. They taught the kids about the nuance of art and activism, and I feel a great deal of success. And it came around. So it's not that they did not want to give this to me. They're still my family. And I'm not going to say I don't want it. I'm going to say I'll defer it. Rather than give this theater my name, I would like to give these students my message to them.
A black cloth covers a poster board.
So it is with great honor that I unveil the new name of this theater, the Gerard Carmichael Theater. I'm just kidding. I'm totally joking.
He lifts the cloth.
Let me see if I can get this here. This theater should be called...
The board reads, Theater for Artistic Freedom and Expression.
The Theater for Artistic Freedom and Expression. I want that for myself, and I want it for every student that's educated at this school.
Audience members stand.
And when and if you are ever ready, you can put my name right on top of that. I love you, Duke Ellington. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Credits appear beside a clip from 2004.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to bring off his new album, Least Renewed, the first single, Flow to You. Give it up for the best theater history teacher in the world, Mr. Lease.
In a classroom, an older black man, Mr. Lease, plays guitar. Beside him, a young brown-skinned man stands with a saxophone. Dave sits among the students, smiling and singing along. Audio description provided by International Digital Center. Written by Liz Gutman. Voiced by Sri Gordon. Credits: Executive Producers, Dave Chappelle, Ricky Hughes. Director, Ricky Hughes. Editor, Jeff U. Wren. For Mom, Dad, Brother, Sister, and My Ellington Family. And as always, Elaine.
I'll see you next year.
2022. Copyright Pilot Boy Productions.
This is protected by the red, the black, and the green at the crossroad with a key.
The C logo.
A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.